Good evening. Good evening, everyone. And welcome this evening for tonight's panel discussion, Don't Look Back, Radical Thinkers in the Arts Since 1909. As you can see, we've got a stellar panel assembled here today to address this question, which we're very pleased to welcome. And I'll be introducing the panel in a few seconds. My name is Paul Goodwin. I'm curator of cross-cultural programs here at Tate Learning, at Tate Britain. And before I hand over to our chair, Alberto Toscano, who will be leading the discussion, I'd like to briefly explain a little bit about the event, the format for tonight's event. So after my introduction of the panel, Alberto will lead off with some questions to the to each of our panelists and have a session which will last roughly an hour, which will leave us about half an hour or so to open it up to the floor. Moderated by Alberto. And please, if you want to ask a question, which we encourage you to do that, or make a comment, would you just raise your hand clearly so we can see you, so one of our mic runners can see you to pass the mic to you. And if you could wait for the mic to reach you before you speak, because we are recording tonight's talk. Also, just to note that they're following the talk at about 8 o'clock in the Claw Foyer, our authors will be signing books, and there will be drinks for your refreshment as well, and you're welcome to join us for that. And finally, I'd like to say a huge thank you to our partners in this event, Verso Books and New Statesman, and in particular to Sarah Shin and Kaylin Breuer at New Statesman for all their hard work in making this happen. So to tonight's distinguished panel, many of whom I'm sure you're very aware of their works. Terry Eagleton is a distinguished professor of English literature at the University of Lancaster in the Department of English and Creative Writing. His many books include classics such as Literary Theory and Introduction, 1983, The Ideology of the Aesthetic in 1990, and The Illusions of Postmodernism in 1996. Terry has recently written Walter Benjamin, or Towards a Revolutionary Criticism, in set four of the Radical Thinkers series by Verso. And also Reason, Faith and Revolution, Reflections on the God Debate, and the forthcoming book, The Task of the Critic, Terry Eagleton in Dialogue. Simon Critchley is chair and professor of philosophy at the New School for Social Research in New York, and the author of several important works in continental philosophy, the history of philosophy, literature, ethics and politics. He's the author of Ethics, Politics, Subjectivity, Derrida, Levinas, and Contemporary French Thought, also in set four of the Radical Thinkers series, and also Infinitely Demanding, Ethics of Commitment and Politics of Resistance. He's also the author of The Book of Dead Philosophers. Kate Soper is a professor in the Department of Humanities, Arts and Languages at London Metropolitan University, and the author and contributor to over a dozen books on continental philosophy, feminism and environmental issues. She's the author of To Relish the Sublime, Culture and Self-Realization in Postmodern Times, with Verso. Also, What is Nature? Culture, Politics and the Non-Human, in 1995. Troubled Pleasures, Writings on Politics, Gender and Hedonism. We also have an architect on the panel this evening. A.L. Weitzman, is an architect and director of the Centre for Research and Architecture at Goldsmiths College, University of London, and a writer on architecture and the politics of spatial practice. Ayle is the author of A Civilian Occupation on Verso Books in 2003, and also the award-winning Hollow Land, Israel's Architecture of Occupation with Verso, in 2007. And last but not least, our distinguished chair, Alberto Toscano, is an editor of the journal Historical Materialism, and who I believe are having a big shindig in London this weekend, and also a lecturer in sociology at Goldsmiths College, also at the University of London. He's the author of The Theatre of Production, Philosophy and Individuation Between Kant and Deleuze, and a forthcoming book on fanaticism called Fanaticism on the Uses of an Idea. So without further ado, I'd like to hand over to our chair, Alberto Toscano, to start off our panel this evening. Thank you very much.
And I wanted to begin with some initial comments just to orient the discussion, after which I'll ask our various speakers to intervene on some specific questions. And I'd like to begin with a passage taken from Filippo Tommaso Marinetti's Futures Manifesto, whose centenary is marked by the Tate Modern's exhibition on futurism and, in a way, by this panel discussion. And Marinetti writes the following: museums, cemeteries, identical surely in the sinister promiscuity of so many bodies unknown to one another, museums, public dormitories where one lies forever before hated or unknown beings, museum, absurd abattoirs of painters and sculptors ferociously slaughtering each other with color blows and line blows the length of fought-over walls. I wanted to quote this passage as a reminder of one of the meanings of radicalism that may be most foreign to a culture such as our own, rather obsessed with anniversaries, retrospectives, and archives. For a number of reasons, some of them, I suppose, very justified, the call to destroy or abandon what Marinetti calls the registries of aborted beginnings, museums, libraries, and academies, today generally falls on deaf ears. Needless to say, Marinetti, like a proverbial punk rocker, persisted long after the age when, as he put it, he should have been thrown in the basket like a useless manuscript. The commemoration of futurism, worse, its institutionalization and neutralization under fascism, long precedes these and other anniversaries. But what are we to make, artistically and politically, of the imperative not to look back? Especially in a historical moment when most today are either incapable, unwilling, or simply petrified to look forward, when, in the terms of the Futurist Manifesto itself, hurling defiance at the stars seems neither safe nor particularly wise. This event is also intended to launch the fourth series of Versus Radical Thinker series, a project that inevitably leads us to reflect on more than 80 years of radical thought. Lukács's Lenin is from 1924, Benjamin's The Origin of German Tragic Drama from 1925. Scanning this latest batch of books, that is, looking back, may invite regret over some tragic defeats or paths not taken. It may inspire a disenchanted gaze on the disparate intellectual strategies and styles that might count as radical in different periods, the 20s, the 50s, the 90s, or even on the incompatible and hostile theoretical commitments of a number of authors who are featured in this collection. Lukács and Virilio probably would not get along. Or, and the recovery and distribution of these volumes at healthily non-academic prices might suggest this, it could lead one to see them as resources of sorts for contemporary radicalism. Indeed, as texts whose greater or lesser anachronism might give them an advantage over contemporary works whose aspirations to relevance make them outdated before they've even left the shelf. Starting from these two disparate occasions, the centenary of a modernist manifesto for destructive creativity and a reconsideration of 20th century radical thought, this panel is intended to explore a number of questions which concern the history, present situation, and future prospects of the relationship between art, theory, and radicalism. The first set of questions involve the very meaning of radicalism today, the political trajectory of futurism, its fierce nationalism, militarism, and misogyny. Already suggested the complacent identification of radicalism, or indeed revolution, with the left is rather problematic. Indeed, we could even ask ourselves, of course, if a number of the figures included in the Radical Thinker series are straightforwardly left-wing thinkers. Baudrillard and Virilio again come to mind. At a time when ecological crisis and the continued depredations of a relatively undead neoliberalism lead people on the left to want to conserve or defend nature, the public, or the local, what does it mean to be radical in politics and or in theory? Conversely, if radicalism means going to the root, which the young Marx famously defined as man himself, what are the basic realities or mystified processes that radical thought and practice would access or unveil today? And how do we stand towards, for instance, the legacy of postmodernism, whose radicalism rejects the human root for the sake of surface, transparency, simulation, or seduction? This indeterminate, or relatively indeterminate, meaning of radicalism, which brings together the novel, the fundamental, the extreme, the subversive, the shocking, is at play in both art and politics. It could even be argued that much art still requires a theoretical guarantee, as well as a political reference to vouch for its own radicalism. Vice versa, radical theory, however construed, is more and more led to find its audience in art-related venues, such as this one. How do we evaluate this seeming symbiosis? Is it a kind of mutual parasitism, a fragile pact between two relatively enfeebled practices? Artists compelled to name-drop theory to legitimize their work, and theorists obliged to feign an interest in art to find an audience or indeed even a paycheck? Does it provide some kind of opportunity which, beyond the all too obvious co-optations, allows emancipatory energies to find some tactical room? And without invoking some fatuous authenticity, how do we separate a kind of radicalism as a sort of survival strategy within the academia or the art world from ideas and practices that could have some perches outside these, to quote Marinetti again, registries of aborted beginnings? The manifesto, and this is the last thing I wanted to touch on, partly because we're referring to Marinetti's 1909 manifesto at least as a date, is a rhetorical form that combines radical negation and bold affirmation, giving modernism its programmatic or promissory dimension. Recently, the Tate, indeed the Tate Britain, hosted the Alter Modern exhibition curated by Nicolas Bourriaud. In his amphibious role as a star curator and remixer of contemporary theory, Bourriaud produced a manifesto for the show under the radical rubric, Postmodernism is Dead. What's peculiar about this text is this odd feeling that one is dealing with a kind of remix or mashup of 90s globalization theory, post-colonialism, and post-structuralism. What is detourned, unlike in Debord, is no longer Marx or Lukács, but something that sounds more like Anthony Giddens. I read from the manifesto, increased communication, travel, and migration are affecting the way we live. Destruction and affirmation are replaced by a vague demand for what is called creolization, the invocation of a new universalism based on translations, subtitling, and generalized dubbing. And perhaps one wonders if this is a sign of a waning of artistic and political radicalism. So I'd like to begin by posing a question to Terry Eagleton. The author to which you dedicated your book in the Radical Thinker series, Walter Benjamin, was of course an incisive critic of futurism in particular and of ideologies of the future in general, famously calling for revolutionaries to pull the emergency brake on the locomotive of history. So I was wondering, first of all, whether you think that his call to politicize aesthetics remains one that is pertinent today, whether the project of what you called in that book revolutionary criticism still has a kind of purchase or relevance. And secondly, I suppose perhaps relating to the comments about the Alter Modern exhibition, you once referred to postmodernism as a sick joke, which I quite like this sentence, as a sick joke played on the avant-gardes, realizing the avant-garde's call to fuse art and life, but under the homogenizing rule of the commodity. So wondering if, like Bourriaud, but perhaps for different reasons, you think postmodernism is dead, and if so, what role could art and thought play in its burial?
Can you hear this all right?
Yeah.
No? Yes? Okay. I've read this question already, so the appearance of anarchic avant-garde spontaneity is purely spurious here, yes. I didn't write my Benjamin book recently, as Paul Goodwin implied. I wrote it ages and ages ago. But I have a sneaking fondness for it because it's the first book of mine in which I dared to crack a joke. Since then, I've done nothing else, really. One set of glib, facetious comments after another. You know, I'll be playing the Glasgow Pally next, probably. But of course, Benjamin's angel, to respond to the question, Benjamin's angel of history looks backwards, looks to the past, and only by confronting the horror, the nightmare of the past, is blown into the future. Future we can't see, and therefore it's logical to see it as behind you rather than in front of us. So it's strange to me, surprising to me, that there should be a radical session like this called Don't Look Back. Mm-hmm. Yes? The past is what we're made of. The past is a precious resource for radical action in the present and the future. Those who try to erase the past, as say in the project of fascism, are annihilating vital, precious elements for us now. I think it was Trotsky who said, "We Marxists have always lived in tradition." Marxists are traditionalists, quite properly. It's just that our traditions aren't, you know, the changing of the guard or something. There are, after all, other traditions. Benjamin, of course, like Adorno, obeys the Jewish interdiction on trying to look, on trying to see the future, because to see the future is to risk making a fetish of it. You're forbidden to make an image of the future, because the only image of the future that matters is the failure of the present. That's the only image of the future you're ever going to have, and anything else is just likely to be something rather consoling. The present for Benjamin and for Adorno are in fragments, and those fragments are not to be prematurely healed by some sort of easy utopianism. For both of them, only God can heal the fragments of the present. Wholeness belongs to the God of the future, who you are forbidden to speak of, because the only image of him is human beings, right? So fragments are what you're stuck with, in that sense, and only in a negative sense, then, I think, for both Benjamin and Adorno, can you talk about utopia. Only God can make those fragments whole, and it would be blasphemous for us to try to do so, which means to try to grab now for an image of, or even a reality of utopia would be drastically premature. The great avant-gardes to which both Benjamin and Brecht belong, that sweep exhilaratingly across Europe all the way from the years, the euphoric years of the Bolshevik Revolution, with its ferment of cultural experiment, right to the Weimar Republic, and then as it were expire somewhere around 1972 with the folding of Situationism. I think that the more materialistically minded of those enormously exciting artists and intellectuals realized that art couldn't go it alone. Yes? If people like Brecht and Benjamin were possible, they were made possible by the existence of a mass political movement. They were made possible, in their case, by a Weimar Social Democratic Party that had its own theaters and clubs and newspapers, recreational centers and so on. Now, artists, it seems to me, let alone intellectuals, can't legislate that into existence. Yeah? As far as that kind of avant-garde attempt to dismantle the very conception and institution of art by integrating it into a revolutionary form of life, as far as that goes, we don't call the tune. It is, as it were, the political situation which calls the tune. What's possible then, I think, is very, for artists, is very much limited by that. And I think people like Benjamin and Brecht realize that. The avant-gardes didn't collapse, the revolutionary avant-gardes of Bolshevism or Weimar didn't collapse of their own internal contradictions or something. I mean, they were full of grievous flaws, but they were politically rolled back. The Bolshevik avant-garde was smashed by Stalinism. Mayakovsky commits suicide in 1930. The Weimar avant-garde was crushed by fascism. In both cases, unlike high modernism, which is another story altogether, they knew that unless they had a sustaining and victorious political movement, they themselves were doomed. They couldn't do it themselves, and that's a fairly authentic kind of materialist insight. Let me just end by trying to address the question about, you know, is postmodernism dead? Well, postmodernism covers a multitude of things, doesn't it? You know, everything from, you know, Foucault to Madonna. And the question, I mean, it seems to me, you know, to give a feeble, fence-sitting, spineless kind of answer to the question, some of it is and some of it isn't, yes? If you mean by, lots of things you can mean by postmoderns, if you mean the final, utter integration of cultural production into general commodity production, against which, as it were, high modernism represented the last-ditch, 11th-hour resistance. Modernism and mass culture were born at a stroke around, say, 1900. They were born together, and the one, modernism, is shaped by its Olympian and disgusted resistance to that culture. Postmodernism is the final, as it were, integration there, but in a different set. But postmodernism is a lot of other things. For example, the end of grand narrative, supposedly. Yes. Now that I think is, in that sense, I think postmodernism is dead. Mm-hmm. I think its claim that grand narratives have come to an end is most certainly dead and buried. Why? A multiple series of ironies there, which I'll try to go through very quickly. The proclamation of the end of grand narratives, that, you know, reason, science, progress, enlightenment, Marxism, classical liberalism had all ground to a halt, and now capitalism, liberal democracy was the only game in town. The announcement of that in, say, the 1990s, ironically, was actually a reflection of a very brutally triumphalist Western capitalism that was rolling its way across a whole number of communities. So, as it were, the rather modest pragmatism of the death of history, post-metaphysical, post-theological, actually reflected a very, very globalized and advanced and aggressive campaign. The result of one result of that campaign was to unleash a new grand narrative. In other words, in the very act of trying to close down a particular grand narrative, another one was unleashed, namely radical Islamism. The war, the so-called war on terror, then followed from that. And I think another irony is that what's now happening, if one looks at the the God debate, why is everybody talking about God suddenly? You know, when he'd happily retired from a miserable career, you know, having deeply regretted creating even the most tiny particle of matter, you know, let alone Britney Spears or somebody, you know. And just at that very moment, the spotlight sweeps onto him, he's dragged back centre stage. Lots and lots of reasons for that, not all connected by any means with 9/11 and the war on terror, but some of them are, because what these guys say, you know, Dawkins and Hitchens and so on are doing partly is actually reviving old-style Western 19th century grand narratives. Mm-hmm. Progress, science, reason, smug, triumphalist repetitions of narratives that we thought had been left dead and fragmented on the battlefields of the First World War. But now that capitalism has succeeded in unleashing a new grand narrative, as it were, in the East, in its own attempt to close down grand narratives, it's finding itself driven back in very implausible kinds of ways, let's say, to narratives, Western narratives, grand narratives, which we thought pretty much were exhausted. If postmodernism is about the end of grand narratives, then it's most certainly dead, I think, in that respect at least.
Thank you very much. I wanted to pick up on one of the comments that you made about in terms of Benjamin, about the uses of the past, and ask Simon about something you've spoken about recently, which is this turn in both somewhat embryonic attempts at radical politics and in contemporary art to various practices of reenactment, of reenacting previous modes of political or artistic, or indeed avant-garde, practice, I suppose in part to following up on, you know, whether we should or should not look back or indeed look forward. How do you evaluate this turn to these various forms of political and artistic repetition, whether this is in a sense a kind of sterile compulsion to repeat or to simulate what might have appeared for politics in previous moments. But I also wanted to ask you a second question, which follows up on the argument about the nature of postmodernism today, which perhaps to address that more in terms of a certain resurgence in what we might broadly call something like radical theory. And when you the book you published in this series of Radical Thinkers came out in 1999, but collected a number of pieces, which I believe are mostly from the 1990s.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what you think has fundamentally changed in, if anything, in the kind of theoretical conjuncture. Of course, you were writing much more about deconstruction and post-Marxism and so on in that book. And in your recent work, there's other issues at stake, from anarchism to engagements with recent authors like Badiou and Rancière and so on. And the tenor of it seems rather different, even though in that earlier book you also wrote about politics. So I suppose those are the two.
Thank you, Alberto. I think I'm a little bit more optimistic about what's going on in contemporary art and the relationship between contemporary art and forms of radical politics than perhaps you suggested in the introduction. Maybe I could say something about that. I'm not sure the question of whether this is the last gasp of something or something actually rather new, I'm not sure. But I'm curious as to what's going on. So even the utter modern idea, I mean, the idea of the way in which a number of contemporary artists are concerned with collaboration, the construction of something like the construction of something like the idea of a group, a collective intelligence, things like this. This interests me, whatever we think about it. And certainly it's the case that, I mean, one thing that shifted, to go back to the second question, I mean, the context for that work I was doing in the 80s and 90s was a university. I think universities were places you could think. I think they're much more harder, and places where it's harder and harder to think in an interesting way. And that, you know, they've become bureaucratized, managed, sort of dreadful, sort of low-level imitations of corporate culture, in which the exercise of, you know, of critique and reflection is harder and harder to sustain, with certain noble exceptions. So a lot of that energy has migrated into the art world and into different forms of radical politics, and that's interesting. But I want to say something about futurism, because firstly, I love the futurists and hate the futurists, because I don't believe in the future, but I like the idea of the futurist arrogance, the rhetoric. I mean, like, for example, in the first manifesto from 1909, the bit that you quoted about the we intend to sing the love of danger, the habit of energy and fearlessness, exalt aggressive action, feverish insomnia, the beauty of speed, to sing the hymn of the man at the wheel. We glorify war, the world's only hygiene, and so on. The museums, cemeteries, exalting defiance, hurling defiance at the stars. And also Marinetti's idea of imagination without strings and words in freedom, right the way through to the attempt to construct a new orthography and to destroy syntax, I find exhilarating. There's this great essay also by Marinetti on the variety of theatre, on vaudeville, where it says the variety theatre born as we are from electricity. So it's this love of electricity. And the praise of vaudeville in terms of its use of cinema. There's this wonderful line, the variety theatre uses the smoke of cigars and cigarettes to join the atmosphere of the theatre to that of the stage. Right? So the idea of cigarette smoke or cigar smoke as that joining of the audience, that sort of spiritual medium. I find the exhilaration of that rhetoric extraordinary. We've been involved in a project for a number of years called the International Necronautical Society. We did something here, a declaration on inauthenticity in January this year, where we were played by actors, and we were sort of using a certain futurist sort of model of the avant-garde and inhabiting that in order to do something, to push that in a rather different direction. So on the one hand, there's something exhilarating about the rhetoric of futurism. On the other hand, of course, you know, futurism ends up becoming complicit with forms of ideology, in particular, you know, contemporary capitalist ideology, the love of speed, technology, the city, the vitality of business, finance, even the love of abbreviation you get in Marinetti, you know, sort of proto-Twitter, you know, gesture, the destruction of syntax. So there's a way in which that idea of futurism, I find, has been, to say the least, co-opted, internalized. But to go back to the title of the evening, and we should, I don't understand why it's called Don't Look Back. I mean, we should look back. I mean, the left has always been involved, as Terry said, in the project of looking back, which is a question of the cultivation of the radical past as that which can have an effect on the present and the way in which we frame the present. And that might mean a certain prohibition on the idea of the future. So that the future is an ideology, and it's an ideology which attempts to suture the alienation of the past, the alienation of the present. So therefore, I take it that the project that many of us would be involved in would be, as it were, using that radical past in order to, and using that radical past maybe even in the mode of reenactment. I mean, one way of looking at the history of the left is in terms of the attempt to reenact or at least reinterpret certain events. I mean, one way of looking at the history of the left is in terms of the reenactment of the Paris Commune. What does that event mean? And how can it be reenacted? To whom does it belong? Does it belong to the Leninists? Does it belong to the anarchists? So on and so forth. So the sense in which that's one thing I wanted to talk about. In relationship to contemporary art, the question of whether reenactment is, as the question that you put, can revive effective forms of radicalism, or these are symptoms of a current deadlock, I don't know. I don't think the logic of effectivity should be used to govern things. I don't think that there's a necessary hegemony to ideas of Wirklichkeit and Energie. There's something, there's a potential there, I think, in these experiments which interest me. So there's something going on in the emphasis upon, if you think about, for example, something I've been greatly animated by in the last year or so, and I know you've written on this too, is, for example, what was going on with the Tarnak Nine, this group, the Invisible Committee, these Tikkun texts that have appeared. And there we have something which is, you know, at one level, a reenactment of a radical past, right? Which is easily criticizable, right? Just as you criticize Bourriaud, right? In terms of it's not Lukács as much as Giddens that's being used in Tikkun or the Tarnak Nine. It's it's a certain situationism without the Hegelian Marxism. There's that. But nonetheless, although one can raise critiques of that, I do think there's something terribly interesting about that gesture, and in particular the way that gesture is influencing forms of student protest in different parts of the world. I was in Zurich at the weekend, and there's 65 university campuses occupied in different parts of the German-speaking world, and so on and so forth. And if you look at what people are talking about, there's something. So in a sense, it's easy to be dismissive about that and to say, in a rather sort of high-handed way, this is simply a repetition of a radical past, which in a sense isn't really properly being understood. I think something else is being expressed there, which has to be at least listened to, I would say. And the last thing would be in relationship to the question of what is retained from that theoretical moment of the 80s and 90s in terms of where we are now. I guess for me there was an exciting intellectual environment in universities in the 80s, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, which I sort of got the fag end of, but which was absolutely fascinating, where there was a critical mass of people that were doing extraordinarily interesting work, some of whom are dead, some of whom have moved on, some of whom have gone elsewhere. And, that what I look for are signs of the continuation of that. That seems to be more and more difficult to do in a university context for obvious reasons. So if that's bled into the art world, again, it's very easy to disparage that. You can say, well, the art world is just, it's a sort of fanciful use of radical theory to, as it were, legitimize the work of artists. Sure. And the whole thing is framed by institutions which enable it. So it's a sort of institutionally compromised form of critique. But nonetheless, I think there's something going on there too, which I think is interesting.
A lot. Now, I wanted to pick up, I suppose, an element that has to do with a space in which we join discussions of the artistic and the political, which we haven't really spoken about yet, which is perhaps a broader notion of culture. And of course, the futurists were, as some of the passages already quoted intimate, great flamboyant haters of a certain understanding of culture, and indeed actually one of the reasons why they came into a certain conflict with the more conservative branches of fascism, so to speak, was their hatred of Rome, their hatred of archaeology, their hatred of the past, which in that sense made them slightly less directly, perhaps, co-optable. But I was wondering, in terms of the discussions that we've had, I wanted to ask Kate in particular, because she's written in a co-authored book called To Relish the Sublime, a qualified defense of a certain idea of cultural self-realization as part of a radical or emancipatory project. And I suppose one could draw a kind of lineage from the futurists all the way to certain, I think you refer to them as neo-Nietzschean strands within postmodernism, who repeat this kind of hatred or purely negative or destructive relationship to culture. So I was wondering whether you could perhaps address some of the issues that we brought up in terms of the relevance of this idea of cultural self-realization today, and how it might relate to the status of both the question of modernism, postmodernism, and that of politics and art.
Yes, well, the title of the book refers to Matthew Arnold's well-known argument that, left to themselves, people prefer low and easy forms of culture and have, as he put it, to be compelled to relish the sublime. The question mark in the title was actually very important. And we weren't necessarily, I and Martin Ra, my co-author, we weren't necessarily endorsing that kind of position. But there was a general argument that we were trying to develop, to the effect that there's something fundamentally undemocratic and even hypocritical about culture that, as it were, preaches the virtues of cultural fulfillment while denying them to the majority of people, while still sustaining socioeconomic divisions, which mean that most people don't have a chance to enjoy that kind of fulfillment. So that, in that sense, the book was opposing the Nietzschean view of high art as necessarily some sort of preserve of a chosen few who were alone in a position to enjoy it. In fact, in some ways, our concern, I suppose, was more with Benjamin's point that there's no cultural document that's not at the same time a record of barbarism. In other words, that the leisure to produce and enjoy high art, as it were, has always come at the expense of the toil of the exploited. And we were arguing that there's a good measure of truth still in that today, despite Arnoldian-inspired projects to advance the so-called common culture. But there's no denying that in many ways this is a problematic argument, and I think we were aware of a lot of problems and discussed them in the book. And one of them, of course, to bring up the point about postmodernism and modernism, was that it's an argument that really, I think, does go against the grain of the kind of welcome that was often extended to postmodern pluralism and eclecticism as a kind of victory for cultural democratization. As, you know, postmodernism, I think, was seen in many quarters as in some ways getting away from the kind of elitism that had been associated with modernism, and that therefore it was, you know, in some way a kind of realization of a more democratic cultural ideal. I would want to emphasize, I think, that to query that kind of triumphalist reading of postmodernism is not to deny the importance of some forms of its critique of modernism for its elitism, its abstraction, its particularly its art for art's sake kind of posturing and so on. Nor, I think, is it to deny the complexity of the situation today, where, in a way, culture has become so saturating of the social whole that, you know, it's very difficult actually to tease out what is cultural and what's political, I think. And in some sense, all culture has some sort of symbolic political role, I think. But what I think we were trying to argue in the book, and what I remain committed to, I think, is the importance of a more dialectical understanding, an understanding that could recognise both the justification for the critique of modernism that was being made in the postmodern sequel, and the extent to which postmodernism was collusive in a kind of denial to people in general of the forms of enhancement and critical reflexivity that could be gained from engagement with, if you like, more difficult, with more demanding forms of literature and artistic engagement. So that was sort of basically the kind of position that we were trying to develop. And I would say that this is an argument that actually seems to have lost none of its relevance. Given the ever-increasing one-dimensionality of our social world and culture, rooted as that is now, I think, in a pervasive naturalisation of market society, global capitalism and the growth economic model of progress and prosperity and self-realisation. And if anything, I would say, I mean, I wouldn't have thought that this was likely to have happened, but it does seem to me that if anything, there is, you know, that this is a naturalisation of the market that is more entrenched than it was when Marx first challenged it, actually, in the 19th century. I mean, I'm not denying, obviously, that the idea of cultural self-realisation is still advanced in arts policy discourses, and it's there in university mission statements about the intrinsic value of the arts, their importance to self-development, and so on. But those kinds of positions are now increasingly in tension with the much more instrumental conception of the individual that dominates in the work world. There's a real gap between these two sorts of positions, it seems to me. What matters in the work world is not your intrinsic personal fulfillment, it's what niche you're going to fill in the economy. It's how much you're going to contribute to growth, and so on. And in fact, the concern with wealth production, now seems so dominant that even the universities themselves are beginning to, as it were, move away from that kind of mission statement and giving up the pretense that they're pursuing other values than those of vocationism. So, you know, in a sense, they're becoming more realistic about what they're going to do in that sense. So in a general way, I have to say I rather welcome this revisiting or reconstellating, whatever you want to call it, of the radical tradition that these Verso texts belong within, because I think, you know, They're very differing from each other, obviously, in lots of ways, but they all share a kind of alertness, I think, to the pressures encouraging the lapse into one-dimensionality. And, you know, they're all in differing ways making efforts to constantly prize that open. And I think that is an important counter to wherever we are now, whether it's postmodernism or post-postmodernism or alter-modernism, and I think I rather share Alberto's views about the ultra-modernist sort of position in the sense that I think it's not so much the quality and the quantity and proliferation of art forms that counts. What we really need to be thinking about is which forms and why. I mean, if we're thinking about art as a vehicle for some sort of radical politics, what we want to be thinking about is not how many forms we generate exactly, but which ones we really want to see, advanced in our time. And that kind of brings me, can I just say something on that issue, on the ecological issue here? Because I think it has to be brought into the picture. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that I deplore the current trends towards vacationism is because I actually see cultural self-realization and education for it as essential elements of ecological survival. And that's because ecological survival, I suggest, now depends on our capacity to shift to a much more materially reproductive way of living, to a, if you like, very low, even no growth economic model, rooted in very different conceptions of prosperity and human well-being. And in that sense, it seems to me we're currently doing practically everything wrong. We're treating idleness and free time as threats to prosperity, when we really ought to be seeing them as forms in which prosperity can be realised. We're treating education as a kind of forcing house for the economy, as an adjunct of industry, rather than the place to prepare individuals for the leisure time available in a post-consumerist era. And we're downgrading and marginalising aesthetic resources and satisfactions when we really need to be making them culturally more central. And as part and part of that, I think we are failing to establish any countering image of the good life to that promoted by consumer culture with its massive advertising budgets. So my last point, I think, would be this, that if there is an art movement for our times, and I'm aware of all the difficulties of using art in that kind of agitprop way. I mean, it's, you know, there's always a sort of sacrifice in some sense, potentially, of the art dimension itself here. But if there is a movement, then I think it would be to promote a counter-consumerist political imaginary. And that's been an important part of what I've been arguing over the last decade in my own work around the concept of alternative hedonism, where I've been calling for a kind of cultural revolution in our thinking about and perception of work and material culture as a necessary first stage. I emphasize this, as a necessary stage, a cultural revolution, as a first stage in building a mandate for more radical socioeconomic change towards a more sustainable culture. And I think, you know, there is an enormous role that art could play in you know, reorchestrating our aesthetic perception of the material world so that a lifestyle that was once seen as compelling, you know, becomes much less so in terms of its association with unsustainable resource use and toxicity, and the legacy of unrecyclable waste. And here, just one very last point, I mean, I agree with the other speakers so far about the importance of looking back, in a way. I mean, I've even started talking about avant-garde nostalgia as a kind of resource for this. And I think, you know, the futurism is a problem here. The futurist kind of position was what we really need, I think, is a celebration of going slow or of taking it easy rather than, you know, the sort of celebration of technology and fast cars and you know, speeding everything up that is part of the futurist manifesto.
Thank you very much, Kate. So I wanted for this last part of our questions, after which we'll move on to broader discussion, to address more specifically this question of the uses of theory and the uses of art. So one of the tendencies, of course, and we've probably engaged in it here, is the question of treating theory either as a resource for the justification of art, or art as a field for the reflection or judgment of theory, and so on. In your own work, Eyal, you in a sense inhabit a position which is transversal to or eccentric towards this kind of distinction. I mean, aside from the fact that, of course, it's especially modern or contemporary architecture has a peculiar relationship both to to art and theory. And you've, in your own work, addressed some of the less, you know, pleasant or emancipatory uses of what would otherwise appear to be radical theory, the you know, détournement, so to speak, of the text of authors like Deleuze and Guattari by the Israeli army and so on and so forth. And you've also, in many ways, used the resources of your thinking and training as an architect to engage in what is a theoretical activity but does not take, and is indeed also political and theoretical activity that does not take familiar, the familiar figure of radical theory as, you know, philosophy judging upon or viewing or reflecting on the world. And in fact, I think you, you mentioned to me at one point the idea of writing, you know, that you essentially in Hollowland wrote a book that was replete with theory, but in which there were really no theorists and no explicitly stated concepts of theory. So I wonder if you could, you know, as neither a theorist who writes about art nor an artist who calls upon theory, whether you could, which is, you know, if you could address how that position may, in some sense or another, displace the kind of art theory discussion that we might otherwise be involved in.
Yeah, I didn't, thank you for this question. I don't know if I can displace it, actually. I think I can probably offer some insight or thing that I've learned from a form of practice that, that I've developed. But initially, I think it's in relation to the last two speakers. No, I guess I, in some point, I'm sharing a certain optimism in the place of emancipatory politics, radical politics, if you like, within within the art or cultural context. But I think we need to, rather than that being a kind of simply a mode of anticipation, we need to ask ourselves how, and you know, how the actual making of that within this context can open ways which are breaking that kind of pact, no? Which on the other on the one hand allows form of radical critique, abstract political ideas to be publicly funded, no? Simply as long as they are kind of irrelevant or not dangerous to the you know, basically the ruling system itself. No, I mean there's kind of like this strange pact, no? That we see more and more kind of pushed towards. But initially, I would like to say that. Maybe for me more in the way that I've been working, you know, the platforms that are offered by art and cultural institute, even by university, is just one of multiple ways of engagement with a political or theoretical question, no? And it's the movement between them that I find most productive. In a sense, I mean, you mentioned also the way in which the use of theory has been kind of detoured or transformed by the Israeli military. In fact, perhaps the closest point to a kind of the futurist nightmare, no, where you know, sort of a kind of a militancy that exists with those you know, radical ideas, no, serving an agenda which for us is absolutely, you know, destructive, counterproductive, etc. So, I mean, these figures kind of emerge in a strange way in the work that I've been doing through, so initially, in order for them to emerge, there need to be a kind of an imaginary that starts bringing architecture, the built environment, etc., into kind of a play of multiple forces, maybe in a sense, no? I mean, since you mentioned kind of a Deleuzian reading of it, within that fabric start emerging those Deleuzians who start doing, who start playing the role of military occupiers of the military machine itself, no? In the context of Israel, Palestine. These, in fact, they operate within the writing as theoretical personas, no? But at some point, and this is also something that I, you know, the kind of I learned myself through that work, they step out. They're alive. They're people who are, they're not only theoretical persona, no? I mean, in fact, one of those people actually emerged out of the book to sue me, right? And at that moment, you start to realize that perhaps there is in a kind of, in a marriage between theory and journalism, a kind of a potential to break into a kind of a political intervention with it. Because on the one hand, and also, of course, I'm speaking within the kind of the context of critique, if you like, radical critique of Israel policies in the West Bank or Israel colonial project itself, there is a place for that. And this is really what, in kind of in this microcosm, really makes clear that paradox. There is a lot of space to articulate any form of idea in the abstract against Zionism within the context of Zionism, no? I mean, you can publish almost anything. Nobody would say a word. The minute that within that kind of theoretical framework there is a kind of an ad hominem attack, right? This is where the kind of the system itself sort of starts shrinking back, no? And in a sense, it kind of picks up on something that you said, in fact, something that we discussed before, no? You said at its root, no, at the kind of the radicalism, it's a return to the root, is a return to the man, no? And perhaps it also needs to be the return to the, ad, in that sense, to the ad hominem, no? And kind of try to find a way in which our kind of theoretical articulations are also bringing up a kind of that level of journalistic engagement. No, so I'm interested in the way in which also through art and culture we can break from we can break that divide of as long as it is kind of transcendent. No, we can even support it. No, as long as it is irrelevant. Or the more radical it is, the more irrelevant it becomes, no? And kind of bring through popular form of enunciation, in fact, a political effect. So for me, journalism is one, no? And kind of that marriage of artistic form or use of artistic institution and journalism as a kind of a commentary on the specific facts on the ground, if you like, and characters that are within that. Or in kind of seeing in architecture, and this is kind of like also using a way in which architecture has of late become a kind of a popular mode of expression, no? I mean, people now, more and more in the last maybe 10, 15 years, no? Architecture is kind of taking a position close to what cinema used to be, no? I mean, architecture is spoken about in a kind of very wide sort of popular context. How one can use that, no, question and propose transformation, political transformation through architecture itself, no? So if you take, and now I will comment perhaps or reflect upon that idea of looking back and agree, of course, with the three previous panelists of the relation, or you know, not giving back that looking back, no, gesture. And say, I mean, if you investigate in the context of the Palestine conflict, the two most abstract, radical concepts that would articulate an idea of equality. One of them being decolonization, and the other one being return, right? Mm. Both of them, in fact, imply a relation to the past, but not as its reenactment, no? Because the way in which such return would be articulated is into present reality. No, and decolonization, perhaps Palestine being the last chance of us to think decolonization as a kind of progressive form of politics, as a way of articulating equality, no, in seeking, in really looking at other previous forms of decolonization and seeing in what way we can use that term in order to disactivate, no, systems of power, systems of separation, no, those multiple separations and multiple inequalities that exist saturated within that space, how that could be disactivated and perhaps transformed, no? Again, the return is never a return, although in a kind of, in a popular, maybe imaginary, a return is too often kind of understood as a return to the rural, no? The village that has been destroyed in 48, in which our claim and our desire for the return is sometimes articulated as that kind of reenactment of, or kind of a return to sort of virgin rurality. But in fact, a return, even if it's rural, is always a return to the urban, is a return to the already built, is a return to a new reality, and a return that can, in itself, kind of fracture the existing fundaments of the of that politics. So, in a sense, and in just to maybe conclude with a particular example, maybe of the way in which again. The continuous experimentation with the form of architecture, either as critique, as resistance, and as now, so initially articulated through books, through writing, through this journalism, but now through the establishment of an office, an architectural office, that exactly is involved with those questions of decolonization and return as they're articulated through through matter, no, through the built environment, through material organization. And seeing that, in fact, the kind of popular form that architecture has, no, rather than kind of just drawing speculative scenarios of a future yet to come and building a kind of a utopia based on a tabula rasa, architecture, in fact, we need to understand, architecture happens, the work of the architect is not the building, the work of the architect is the model, is the planning, is the drawing, no? But the drawing itself or the model is a set of relationships. It could be articulated through popular understanding of what architecture in the built environment is and what is our stakes within it, no? So in fact, what we are kind of experimenting with right now is kind of forms of propositions that are really about rearticulating the kind of political, social relations in the present in relation to the way in which you can imagine and transform spatial realities. I don't know. I mean, it might kind of sound abstract, but I think it is, what is interesting is the way in which those social relations are traversing through or go through those modes of representation, and the way in which that can actually exit the kind of gallery or academic process and become a kind of a language, another language with which we can articulate idea or fundamental transformation.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Eyal. We now have about 25 minutes or so for question and discussion. I'm slightly blinded by the light, so it'll be quite generic who I pick on. Oh, not anymore. And there's runners with mics and so on. So first of all, back there, and then here in front, yes. So we'll take one question at a time, I guess.
Thank you. Direct a question to Simon. You say that you think there are things which are going on in contemporary art and on student campuses in Europe. I guess I'd like to know what it is you think is going on in those campuses. I think those of forms of...
The details of that, you mean?
Well, details, but also, I guess, in the sense that I think they look back, we're talking about looking back to kind of forms of forms and ideas of protest, which they maybe draw on from, yeah, from kind of earlier times, countercultural times possibly, when there maybe did exist a kind of grand narrative which those forms of protest were able to tap into, mm-hmm, and which I personally don't feel necessarily exists today. So I'm just interested in what you think it is that is going on, which is maybe different from the kind of commodified or more empty kinds of forms of art and ideas.
It's a good question. I mean, and there's, the three contexts I'm thinking of opposition to the Bologna Accords, which is, there was a week of action last week, particularly in the German-speaking world, but also elsewhere, but mainly in the German-speaking world, which involved a huge number of campuses and a series of occupations that were very interesting. I took part in one in Zurich because I just happened to be there. And the second context would be what's going on in the UC system, in the California system, and there's someone here who's a representative, someone who's involved with that over there, Evan, and he could say a lot more than I could say. But I've been reading some of the texts that have been coming out of Santa Cruz and looking at what's been, speeches being made at mobilizations in Berkeley and all the rest, and it's... That's interesting. And then the third context is close to my own, which is the New School. The New School for Social Research is part of a thing called the New School, which is this large, strange entity, of which Alberto was a former student. And it's we've had a year-long, fairly bloody conflict with our president, which resulted in a vote of no confidence last year and a series of occupations and mobilizations. So there's all of that. Those are the details. then you've got, as it were, the political, you know, what's coming out of that in terms of, there's a lot of texts that are coming out, which are interesting, which, I mean, the ones that I've been, and also they're circulating by hand. I'm often, you know, someone will come into my office and say, read this and disappear. And there's this nice, you know, anti-technological idea of, you know, the distribution of the text by hand, which I rather like. And a lot of them are in the guise of certain, let's say, anarcho-communist invisible committee ideas. There's a lot of those texts that are being produced and other things as well. Now, on the one hand, that can inspire... I wasn't part of the 60s generation. I was far too young, as is obvious. And is, you know, I was a child of, you know, the punk, and I thought hippies chased me down the street for wearing straight trousers. So I was no friend of 68. But what my senior colleagues, their relationship to that is very interesting, because they're the people that took part, say, for example, in these mobilizations of the 60s. And it's all, at the one hand, it's sort of, oh, there, that's very nice and good for you. And on the other hand, it's a rather patronizing attitude, and the idea that we've seen this and done this all before. Okay, so if you read these texts, in a sense, there are echoes of the radical past in all sorts of different ways, different sorts of avant-garde moments. It's very easy to criticize, but the demand that's being articulated here, the demand is it has to be listened to, and it's a demand for a space which is not governed by a university reduced to forms of commodity exchange, for example. And these are demands which I think are exemplary and what it's led to. So you know, that's going on, and that's interesting. I'm unaware of whether that's going on in the UK in the same way. I've been away for too long, but. And so I spend a lot of time with these students just listening to them. And it's extremely interesting, because it's not just an activist project. It's incredibly intellectual. They're working through all sorts of texts and traditions and coming up with their own proposals and solutions. And I find that it gives me it's really interesting.
Thanks. So there's a question there.
I have a question about what wasn't talked about. Although it relates to the very beginning, which I think a proper questioning in the context of radicalism of certain institutions, the art gallery, the university, and so forth, and whether, in fact, radicalism can exist in those institutions. Don't Look Back signals to me a film about Bob Dylan, which hasn't been mentioned. And in the Todd Haynes film I'm Not There, there's a scene in which a group of Black Panthers listen to the Bob Dylan song Ballad of a Thin Man, which has the lyrics, something is happening, and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? And I'm tempted, with the greatest respect, because I hugely enjoyed the discussion, to put something like a version of that question to the Mr. Jones and Ms. Jones on the panel. Because I don't think this conjunction of theory, the New School, Santa Cruz, the Tate, and so forth is necessarily going to be the place where radicalism is happening. And so among the things that weren't mentioned, along with Bob Dylan, for some reason, despite the title, for example, is cinema, but let me just mention a scene from, there's a Palestinian film just come out called The Time That Remains by Eli Suleiman. It's a beautiful film. It ends with the director looking very quizzically at a group of young Palestinians who are dressed in rap clothing. They have baggy jeans, but they also have the traditional scarf. And you talked about capitalism creating Islamism, but it seems to me that the radical things that may be happening are, for example, the interpenetration of hip-hop and rap with radical Palestinian self-consciousness among the young. And all these things are beyond the purview of everything that was spoken about, but they may precisely be the radical things.
I'm very pleased about that intervention and grateful for it, actually, because I mean, one of the things that I did want to say, in a way, is that I'm sure there is a great deal going on, actually, that you know, people of my generation aren't necessarily au fait with or accessing in that sense at all. And I think it is actually very important that we should kind of hear from you about this kind of developments. I mean, I'm still, in a way, to try to connect up with the previous question, I guess I still would like to hear from you, say, who are more optimistic or confident about these alternative forms of radicalism about which, you know, true, fair enough, we probably are not aware, or not very much, and we don't know what's going on, so I mean, I'm happy to plead guilty there, but I'm still, my sense at the moment, and I would like to be persuaded otherwise, is that there isn't a very linked up, holistic sense of a political alternative, and even less so of really what would be the agents of transformation associated with that politics. I mean, what is the larger framework of thinking in which these forms of radicalism are developing? And also, how, I mean, are they, and how would they link up with the new needs of our times to not only build for social justice globally, but to challenge a completely unsustainable economic globalized model of the economy, it seems to me. So, I mean, it seems to me that, granted everything you're saying, there is also a question that I might kind of put back to you here about how you see that those forms of radicalism hooking up into something more holistic and revolutionary, I suppose, and more radical in its transformative power. Did you want
to? Well, only to say, I mean, futures are not necessarily pleasant, are they, at all? You know, one may dread and fear the future, but they do happen. And recently, very recently, one almost happened in an extremely big way, namely the possible collapse of the present capitalist system. Yeah? If that is not a momentous future, you know, we were about half an hour from the cash machines closing down. I don't know what is. So I don't know what it means to say one doesn't believe in a future. People normally believe, say by that, one doesn't believe in some airy fairy utopian future. Well, certainly Marxists don't believe in that. Marxists believe in a future that, as they in the traditional term, is imminent in the present, not just some wouldn't it be nice if subjunctive possibility that you tack on to the present, but looking for the lines of force within a present, which are always there, which are contradictions within it, and which may break it open into a future which Marx, another Jew along with Adorno and Benjamin, has absolutely nothing to say about. Because you can't have the future in your pocket, but you can say what here and now might point towards a different set of possibilities, and they, as I began by saying, are not always pleasant. You know, if capitalism had collapsed, then the reason why we desperately need organized oppositional political forces is so a lot of people won't get hurt when that happens. So there will be ideas of possible alternatives, not just, and here I think I disagree with Simon, not just spaces within the present, not just subversion, a word that was missing in I think, your introduction, you talked about subversion, and is transformation. You have to have forces, some idea of institutions that are prepared to do that. Now, unless you have that in a big way, as you had in the Weimar Republic, as you had in the years of the early Soviet Union, you can forget about revolutionary art. Oh, yes, of course, any one of us individually, you know, may do that, may do interesting things, experiments. But we're talking about a mass movement of artistic innovation that could only survive because it had its roots sunk deep in a political movement that it itself couldn't control. We are belated as far as that movement goes.
That's right.
Thank you very much. Other questions? There's two on the... It's a very fertile row. you first and then...
At a seminar recently, I came across an interesting remark pertinent very much to the need to revisit our past for a sort of forward-looking outlook, to revisit the past, and it was Heinz Klaus Metzger in Was Heldnis zur History, which he said, no past is safe from the present and future. Dialectic has retroactive as well as prospective power. And there's always been, I can never forget that nice phrase in that nice quote in Terry's book, After Theory, of Yeats's, nothing can be soul or whole that has not been rent. And also, Kate Soper, I think you quote Yeats too in one of your early books, can we know the dancer from the dance? I sort of run an informal forum on philosophy and art, and our particular interest is in how can we get beyond this sort of swing backwards and forwards that we inherit from Cartesian dualism and positivism between atomism, that is endless detail and information that makes everything intractably complex, and its opposite pole of holism, that is the sort of Charybdis to the Scylla that tries to fit everything to a scheme and in the process oversimplifies and ignores what doesn't fit. I was just wondering what the panel might have to say about, you know, academia identifies these two ways of seeing atomism and holism, and Kate has alluded to something, we need something that is forward and more dynamic, I would say Hegelian and triadic, rather than binary and static that we inherit from the Enlightenment. And I was wondering what thoughts they have about how do we get out of the sort of vicious circularity that comes from positivist in Enlightenment view of perception to a sort of virtuous circularity, because perception and reasoning and language and interpretation are always going to be circular. And somehow there seems to be some need for a sort of dynamic, Hegelian, Marxian dynamic to take us forward out of this. I was wondering what thoughts they might have on that.
Thanks a lot. Does anyone want to respond to that?
Well, the work of art as defined by the Enlightenment, yes, the aesthetic work of art, isn't it, among lots of other things, one attempt to answer the question about atomism and holism, because the miracle of the work of art, according to traditionalist classical aesthetics, is that there is indeed a law of the whole, a kind of totality, but one which operates only in and through the relations between its minute sensuous particulars. Yeah? The work of art is a kind of substitutionary attempt, I think, to answer this vexed question, certainly dogs capitalism from end to end, of how does the sensuous in particular relate to something more general. In capitalist society, those two things are riven apart. Now, if the work of art is the answer to that, we're really in a very bad way. You know, I mean, how many people are involved with works of art? But Marx also has his own version of that answer, namely when he says in the Communist Manifesto that the free realization of each will be the condition for the free realization of all. That is Marx's idea of communism, yeah? That the individual, the realization of the individual is the very basis for the realization of the whole, not its antithesis. And what's wrong with a certain Enlightenment conception of rationality is that it rides roughshod over the particular. The answer to that, however, is not a kind of romantic myopism of the particular, yeah, which disdains all totality as bogus, postmodernism, for example, a recent current of that, but rather to think of the totality differently, yes, to think, as Marx tries to, of a whole society which would exist only in and through the difference, the respected differences of its members. Yes.
Yes. Thanks, and I say this not remotely in the capacity of someone involved with the UC things. I'd be happy to talk about that with people, but I don't want to color what I'm saying by that and vice versa, because I sort of want to honor Marinetti a little bit, or at least put him back on the table. I mean, if not by a firecracker or a fist fight or drinking a cocktail made of gasoline or eggs, but by thinking about maybe what's worth saving a little bit in there. And it seems to me there's a couple things of value. Marinetti has that remarkable anti-pasta manifesto where he rails against the heaviness of carbohydrates weighing down young Italian soldiers, and the new light rails the future, which to me sort of nails the thing Simon was talking about, the sort of exhilaration of these sort of visions of setting off towards the future, albeit not knowing where. There's that, and there's the sense of the graveyard, right? The graveyard of the past, of the declaring the cemetery to be, or sorry, declaring the museum to be as such, to be cemetery. And I'm wondering if there's a way to think about the sense of don't look back in a way of something like this that actually to me seems to fit very much in the present. I indeed share the sense of that one lacks a sort of grounded, embedded movement from which radical art could speak or these deeper things. The fact is, however, though, that we're at a moment of urgency in which something like that to me doesn't seem to be either the case or immediately possible. And as such, I would want to start to think what it means to declare certain traditions as a kind of a graveyard to be raided in this way, and also to maintain some of the urgency of the sense of the light movements. You talked about these sort of odd combinatory forms that indeed we don't know where to situate them, these sense of how does one make sense of these weird kind of cross moments of something like emergent forms of Islam, you could imagine American hip hop, et cetera. But I guess I would like to hear what people's senses of how, given the fact that if not all Western culture is a graveyard, we nevertheless, our radical past right now seems to be one, at least insofar as it's not embedded, lived in any ways where we can immediately work off of that in terms of radical art or grounded movement of unions, et cetera. And it seems to me that one of the things to guard out of Marinetti, despite obviously the deeply, deeply problematic horizons that led to, is a certain sense of that sort of declarative rhetoric and of urgency in a moment where you don't know where you stand, where the ground is falling out from under you, as we know it is financially, politically. And so I just would like to hear a little bit of the sense that to me it was lacking in the discussion, which is to me the utter, utter urgency of a situation that has much like those railroad cars full of overfed Italian men going off the rails. The point would be then how much you try to gather them back the way they were as opposed to some other sort of explosive gesture. So.
Well, I welcome the futuristic enthusiasm, and I also like the sort of absurdity of the. I mean, there's also the manifesto on past, there's a manifesto on men's clothing, which is also fascinating, against dark colours, and it would cause havoc in the art world. You know, people shouldn't wear blacks and greys and browns; they should wear brightly coloured outfits. And the manifesto on lust and such things. There is something enormously exhilarating about that. I agree. I think I also agree with your sense of urgency. I mean, sure, wider. I mean, the question, I mean, in relationship to what the previous questioner raised and other, I mean, do we know what's happening? Well, I don't know what's, sure, no. I mean, it's one's view is partial. But the, and there's a risk in what I was talking about in relationship to what's going on in the student world of a, of a politics of abstraction, right? A politics of abstraction which isn't based on effective linkages to other forms of struggle. We've seen that before. We've seen that repeatedly in the history of the student movement, and sure, it's there. And obviously, there, in order for there to be transformation, there has to be a linkage between these forms of radicalism and wider movements. I'm not convinced that we're not there. I mean, I think it's a question of articulation. At that point, I think there's enormous anger, frustration, disenfranchisement, which requires mobilization, and I think it's not being mobilized. It's being sutured by different things, like Obamaism is a suturing of that. But I think there is a need for an urgency, and there are. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so you're going Okay, so maybe just briefly, regarding that question of urgency, one would say, I mean, urgency to what? And in a sense, isn't there also a problem of being reactive, no? I mean, in a sense, letting the kind of the sort of emergencies of the present day dictate our agenda. And I think that, in a sense, perhaps the one way to look at them as kind of moments of possibilities, of possible ruptures, but that are articulated, could be articulated towards a kind of, or with certain principles that that are not that are beyond the kind of amelioration, beyond the kind of a reaction to this or that kind of moment of injustice, but seen as kind of moments of possibility. And I think that therefore you need that kind of you know, you need also a kind of a sort of a larger scale perspective in relation to that kind of activist kind of forms of engagement.
Yes, I mean I sort of sympathize with the sense of the need for a certain kind of urgency, and for I think the behind that is also a sense that perhaps we haven't got enough sort of energy and dynamic and imaginative and alternative kinds of ways of presenting the new imaginary for our times, as it were, the one that would take us beyond the actual and into some more post-consumerist conception of well-being and social justice and so on. But I'm not at all convinced myself that I can find anything to inspire me in the Futurist Manifesto, because it's, one of the odd things to read the Futurist Manifesto now is to feel how incredible and what a graveyard it is. It celebrates misogyny, it celebrates the automobile, it celebrates technology for technology's sake. And it obviously veers off into fascism eventually. So, in lots of ways, I think that it's very difficult to defend futurism as offering us anything but very anachronistic ideas now. So, I urgency, yes, but I don't think in the form that futurism offered it us, no.
Thank you. We just have time for one last question. That was, you had your hand up here at the front. After which, unfortunately, we'll have to close, and then there'll be drinks, and then you can sort of ambush various speakers if you so wish. So please.
I just wanted to ask two questions. One was for Kate. I kind of got excited when you said that we should think about ecological ways of living, and you wanted to bring the ecology into the debate. Mm. But then I felt sort of immediately disappointed that you were talking about a celebration of slowness and taking it easy. Into my head came the books that are all over Foils and Waterstones by Tom Hodgkinson, mm-hmm. and this awful journal of idleness that seems to be produced by very privileged upper middle class white men who seem to be kind of returning to their estates in Devon. And they lecture us about how to be idle. And also the book by, I think, a French author who wrote a book called, I think it was called something like The Art of Slowness, which to my shame I read. And it seemed to focus very much on his sex life, on a sort of a kind of Sting and Trudy, how to find greater meaning to some kind of Buddhist style of sex. Yeah. I didn't quite follow it. You had to have a lot of money to pay for these sex sessions, which were very inspiring. If I had enough money, I'd definitely sign up. So I wondered if you could speak a bit more about that. And I suppose I wanted to sort of ask you all, perhaps, I'm a journalist, and I perhaps wanted to sort of spread this over to you about your point about journalism. I mean, I'm a very disillusioned journalist. I used to work, for my shame, for the BBC, and I left the BBC. And one of the things I've really struggled with in the last 3 years is surviving as a freelance, independent journalist. It's, I've written for academic journals. I've written for academic books. It's a great, the academics all love it. And one of the reasons it's wonderful is because they think we shouldn't be paid. Now, you all presumably have paid jobs, and I know that academics work very hard, and I know that academia is under threat, but I wondered if you were able to make that statement about, I mean, I hope I'm not being too critical, but about the good way of life, because you have I'm assuming, a salaried position.
I don't, actually.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, I don't want to personalise it, but I mean, it's a very elitist position, is it not?
I'm glad this has come up, actually, because there's always a risk when you've only got a few minutes to speak that you do it in sloganising ways that kind of risk being misunderstood, and I certainly wouldn't want to have what I, you know, rather glibly threw out as going slow and going easy associated with the books and the positions that you're talking about. I mean, what for me is at the centre of those ideas, which I didn't have time to elaborate on, would be the importance of getting beyond a work-dominated culture. I mean, it seems to me that if we are not to do what Caroline Lucas says we're doing, which is to monitor, you know, being the first species to monitor our own extinction, then we do need very urgently to rethink the commitment to the growth economy, which in turn means rethinking the whole centrality of work, you know, for the production of material commodities for the realization of profits. Because, you know, that is what is driving the whole thing. It's the dynamic of profit-making, which is constantly in need of commodities and services for its realization, which means, in turn, that everybody is caught up in a very work-dominated way of existing. Now, none of the program that I'm suggesting we need to instigate to bring about change in that kind of area. And I would here sort of mention someone like André Gortz as much more my kind of way of arguing for the, you know, for how we might go. Utopian and, you know, usually thought of as, you know, fairly off the wall and so, but I mean, that's how I am thinking through. But I do not see any agency of that form of transformation at the present time. So for me, the only possibility of moving people more into the position where they might mandate those kinds of changes would be by some kind of cultural, you know, I think we need what I've been talking about as a kind of cultural revolution. And this also connects with the question about agency and process and atomism and holism. I think we need people to be enabled to aesthetically and ethically rethink their commitment to the growth economy as a condition of then perhaps mandating political changes of that more radical kind that would then allow us to move to, you know, a more sustainable form of wealth production, which itself would, I think, mean rather more free time and a lot less work. And that's what I mean by that's what I was signalling with this silly little phrase, going easy and going slow. Does that help a bit?
Thanks. Hmm. You wanted to just make a...
No, maybe just clarification. I didn't mean the institution of journalism. I meant a kind of an investigative journalistic element within theory, no? I mean, how would that... Or, in fact, what is more interesting for me now, what is a kind of an investigative journalism element within architecture, no? I mean, in what way does architecture start speaking in a way that is both kind of projective and commentary simultaneously? So that is somehow the marriage of these machines, as I see kind of a potential within them, but not kind of journalism or academia as kind of as their institutional realities.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm receiving signals that we must end the spoken evening's proceedings. So I'd like to thank all of our speakers and everyone.